Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, Gordon Yang, here on behalf of petitioners Jorge Cruz Ramirez and his wife, Felicitas Lopez Zuniga. Two of their daughters, two of their eldest U.S. citizens, are here in the court today as well, but their youngest, Yuridia, is not. She is in school today. And really, this case is about the due process rights owed to my client seated before you, and also their third daughter, who is in school today. This case really is about due process in two ways. First, the immigration judge erred in discrediting their expert witness evidence in evaluating whether any one of their three U.S. citizen daughters would experience exceptional and extremely unusual hardship warranting cancellation of removal and lawful permanent resident status for their two parents.
Isn't that a discretionary determination by the Attorney General over which we do not have jurisdiction to review?
No, Your Honor, it is not a discretionary determination. It is.
You're saying he found extreme hardship and you're asking us to overturn it. On what ground can we overturn it?
It is a non-discretionary determination for two reasons. First, the evaluation calling for an examination of whether exceptional and extremely unusual hardship exists is mandated by the statute. But more than that.
And committed to the discretion of the Attorney
yes.
General under the statute.
At least under our case law. To me, it does never made a lot of sense, but that's what we say. We say that the determination of extreme and exceptional unusual hardship is a discretionary decision.
Let me try to make a distinction.
But can we back up a minute? You have a timeliness problem here. Which seems to be supervening before we ever get to any of this.
If I could, Your Honor, just to continue for 1 minute more on the hardship issue, and then I will come to the jurisdictional issues. I do understand that they're very important in this case.
If we don't have jurisdiction, then you're wasting your time on the merits. So I'd like to hear your answer to Judge Berzon's question
okay.
on jurisdiction.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Three petitions were filed in this case. One over the affirmance without opinion, one over the denial of the motion to reopen, et cetera, and also a petition for writ of habeas corpus.
All right, and the habeas corpus was after Real ID and too late as a petition for review, so it's no good. And the petition for the first one was too late filed. So basically we're talking about the third one.
Well,
right, the third one and the motion to reopen is the important one, is it not? Because if you win on that, then you get a new order, then we can start over again.
It seems clear, Your Honor, that the petition in the third case over the motion to reopen has been timely filed. I don't think there's any dispute.
Yes, that's been timely filed. So therefore, the question is essentially the merits of that,
yes.
Which is the request essentially that they reopen and reissue because you didn't get the order in time.
That's correct. I think ultimately the substantive issues are the same in all three cases, but I would like the court to take note
of I'm sorry, I don't understand that, because so it seems to me that the key question right now is on what basis are you arguing that the BIA was incorrect in denying your motion to reopen as to the question of whether you got timely notice of whether it matters whether you got timely notice of the original order. Isn't that the main question before us at this point? Because then everything unravels backwards after that. I mean, if you win on that, then you go back, you have a new order, you file a new petition for review, you at least have a possibility of voluntary departure, et cetera.
Yes, There are several different ways in which the motion to reopen addresses these issues. First of all, the BIA denied the motion to reopen because they said it was out of time. However, an exception to that rule exists under the regulations at 8 CFR 1003.2. It specifically references an exception under 8 CFR 1023. And I'm sorry, I can't cite.
You're now going to talk about the four zeros at the end of the zip code? Is that what you're going to talk about?
That's leading into it. But really, there is an exception under the regulation that says if a person did not receive notice. Yes.
Yeah.
And essentially, this is an in absentia hearing because My clients were not standing before
the
board.
Records,
there was no oral.
Yeah, the records show the notice was mailed.
Yes.
And it was mailed to the last known address.
Yes.
Except for the final four zeros rather than that specific four-digit zip code that sometimes is used. And you're contending that it was the agency's failure or the agency putting in those four zeros caused that document to be mismailed. Is that your argument?
That is one of our arguments, thank you, Your Honor, that the BIA misaddressed, they incorrectly addressed the notice of the decision in December of 2004, and therefore my clients didn't receive a decision, a copy of the decision, until May 5 when he was taken into custody.
Yeah, well, so that's what they say, but the issue is how do we test the sufficiency of the mailing and the records of the agency? The agency shows that they have a practice of mailing their notices addressed as this form is addressed, and I think that's in the record. But I don't think there's anything in the record as to what effect the four zeros would have when you add that to the address.
There's nothing in the record per se, Your Honor.
What does the record show about the mailing? Does it just have a cover sheet? Does it have an envelope? Does it have any attestation from the agency that this is how they mail things? Or does it have anything but a cover letter?
There is a cover sheet in which prior counsel's address is stated with the incorrect
with the four zeros.
Provided.
And is that it? Is there anything else from the agency?
No, not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay.
Other than their statement that they mailed it to the last known address.
But that's what I'm asking you. In what form is the statement? Is there a declaration? Was there evidence?
Letter,
is there,
Your Honor.
What?
It's a cover letter.
It's a cover letter. That's it.
It's a notice of decision. And right underneath that is...
But there's no actual declaration from anybody in the agency that says, we mailed this cover letter, or that says, we usually, you know, we have a system to make sure we mail these cover letter, or anything like that.
I would like to double-check the decision, Your Honor. It might actually say so in the decision itself, that it was mailed as addressed to prior counsel's address as stated in their
notice. Well, the decision does say that. The BIA decision says a review of the record indicates the board's order was mailed, but the question is on what basis does the BIA record say that, opinion say that?
I would have to double check the decision itself, but I recall somewhere it's saying that the decision is mailed to the address provided to the BIA by the
attorney. It does say that, but I'm asking what in the record substantiates that it was mailed, as opposed to that somebody put together a cover letter.
Yes. Also, in addition to
Did you contact the post office to see what the effect of adding the last four digits of 000 in lieu of whatever the correct digits would have on the deliverability of that piece of mail?
I did not speak with them directly. I looked at an article posted on their website.
And it says, don't do it, it's a bad thing. But does it say it's undeliverable? Or won't be delivered?
It said, basically, the information that I saw said that it's not a good practice. It's not a proper practice. I'm sorry.
Is that in the record?
That's not in the record, but it's in my brief.
That's a representation that you're making in response to my question.
It's in my brief, but it's not in the record below. This is an issue raised on appeal.
So wouldn't it be incumbent upon you, in moving to reopen, to submit that in the form of a declaration, and even better, get something from
the
post office saying that if you do it this way, we might not be able to properly deliver the letter?
Well, I'm sorry that wasn't done, Your Honor. There was a time crunch.
Counsel,
at the
I'm not
time.
Trying to embarrass you. What I'm really asking you as a matter of law is, what's your burden? How much do you have to show in order to demonstrate an abuse of discretion by the board in denying your motion to reopen on this ground?
We have satisfied our burden of proof, Your Honor, under SALTA v. INS.
And actually, all it says in the thing that you quote is that if you put these extra letters in, it will result in the loss of postage discounts. It doesn't say it'll get in the way of delivering anything.
That's correct, Your Honor. But it says that it's not a proper form.
I mean, it seems counterintuitive to me that anybody's going to be confused by a bunch of zeros at the end of a zip code.
That's true, Your Honor. But like in the Third Circuit case, I believe the address there merely lacked the name of the law firm, and yet the circuit overturned the decision below, saying that it wasn't properly addressed.
But quite aside from any improper address, you have a declaration that neither you nor your client received it, right? You've signed a declaration under penalty of perjury saying that, have you?
The prior attorney
did,
yes,
right, okay. And the agency has come back with no further proof of mailing other than a cover sheet.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you very
much. I'd like to reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jan Redfern for the respondent. Your Honors, of the three consolidated cases before this Court today, the Court has jurisdiction only over the petition for review challenging the Board's denial of the motion to reopen. So if there are no questions about the first two petitions for review, I'd like to turn to the motion to reopen. The only decision for which timely petition for review is the Board's denial of the motion to reopen. It's undisputed that the motion to reopen was untimely. So I'd like to turn to the petitioner's claims that there were exceptions to the time for filing a motion.
Let me just clarify one thing first. What would be the consequence of the reopening? In your view, I gather, it would not change the reviewability of the order anyway, really, because you'd say we lack jurisdiction not only because of the lack of timeliness, but also because even if it were timely, we would still lack jurisdiction because it's a review of a discretionary order.
That's
right?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
So, but it would still make a difference, I think, perhaps, with regard to voluntary departure.
Yes, Your Honor. The petitioners did have voluntary departure, and because they failed a timely petition for review of a Board decision, that voluntary departure
and,
is
and they say the reason they didn't depart is because they didn't know they were supposed to because they never got the order.
That's correct.
So that's really what we're ultimately talking about here, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, to succeed on the petition for review of the motion to reopen, the petitioners must demonstrate that the Board failed to comply with the regulations by either not mailing the decision at all, which they claimed to the Board, or what they're saying now is that the Board mailed that to the wrong address. Well, first of all, the petitioners claim that there's an exception to the time limitation existed is incorrect. As noted in the government's brief, they're applying or attempting to apply the statute and regulations for in absentia orders, which this Court in Singh recognizes the huge difference.
But if the thing was not in fact mailed, I mean, the case law is that the time runs from the mailing, so if it wasn't in mailed, then they'd be entitled to relief.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this case, the evidence, as you pointed out earlier, the evidence of mailing is the Board's transmittal letter.
Okay, is that by any ordinary standards, i.e. the standards that would be applied under the mailbox rule in an ordinary civil case, that wouldn't do it? Because that's not evidence of mailing. It's evidence that a cover letter was prepared, but it's not evidence that it was ever put into the mail.
Well, to the contrary, Your Honor, I believe this court in Singh held
that. Well, that's true, but that's pending on a rehearing.
Right evidence
now. Yes, and that's pending on a rehearing right
and
now.
And it doesn't have – I don't know about that, Your
yes,
Honor.
Yes, it is.
I'm unaware of that. Okay.
It is.
But as existing right now, the law in this circuit is that the transmittal letter is evidence of mailing, and absent any rebuttal or presumption.
All right, but that case is pending on rehearing, so I'd like to hear an argument about it ab initio, about why that's correct.
Why the transmittal letter is evidence of mailing?
Right.
Because the Board, in order to comply with its regulations, merely has to demonstrate that it mailed the letter, the decision, to the petitioner at the correct address. And in this case, the transmittal letter is evidence of mailing because the Board doesn't normally put in a return address or an envelope.
All right, but here we have a direct refutation of the mailing, which is we didn't get it under penalty of perjury. So at that point, don't you have more of a burden to demonstrate that it was in fact mailed?
Well, under SALTA, if it's an in absentia case, under SALTA, the
I understand that. I'm just asking ordinarily, if in under the mailbox rule, you're supposed if the issue is whether something was received or not, which is a slightly different issue, there has to be evidence of actual mailing. I put it in the mail. Sometimes that can be satisfied by evidence of a system for mailing. All right, but we have neither here. We have neither a declaration by anybody that I put it in the mail, nor a declaration about how mailing occurs in the INS. We have a cover letter. It is perfectly possible, and I can tell you what has happened in this court recently, that there is a documentation of something having been mailed, and it wasn't mailed. So what? Once somebody comes in and says, I didn't get it, don't you have some further obligation to prove mailing?
Well, under the regulations, no, Your Honor.
The regulations do not address this question, as I understand it. They don't address the evidentiary question of what makes it a mailing.
I believe the regulations state that the board's transmittal letter or the board's mailing of the decision to petitioner
counsel.
Mailing,
yes. Transmittal letter, no. The regulations do not address the transmittal letter as conclusive evidence of mailing. That's what you're arguing. You're arguing the transmittal letter is conclusive evidence of mailing,
again,
even in the face of a declaration that it wasn't received.
And again, the government would rely on this, and I realize that you're saying it's under rehearing at this point, but the government relies on the court's analysis and saying that transmittal letter is evidence of mailing.
Okay, Ms. Redford, let me ask you a practical question. What would the government be able to prove if we said to you the law now is that if a petitioner files a declaration swearing under penalty of perjury that I never got it, what would the agency be able to do by way of countervailing evidence beyond simply pointing to the regulation and the transmittal letter in its file? What additional proof could you offer?
I couldn't answer that at this point because there's nothing in the record, and I don't know
That's
whatever.
That's not my question.
But I understand, Your Honor.
You understand how the agency works.
Yes, Your Honor.
So
but
tell me what you would prove in response to it. What would you try and get?
I couldn't tell you what other evidence is available because
Well, let me
the
suggest
board
an answer to you because I can't think of anything else, and that would be the best the agency could do would be to call a witness from the agency who would come in and testify to what our standard mailing practices are in conformance with our regulation. And beyond that, I can't tell you in this particular case whether or not this piece of mail actually went out. I have to assume that it did because we didn't give it back.
And there is a presumption of regularity with the mail, that the address, that mail that's properly addressed will be delivered.
But we have no – this is what's frustrating. You don't have an envelope, right?
Correct.
You don't have, so you don't have, and you don't have so you do not, in fact, have evidence of mailing. You have evidence of preparation of a cover sheet.
And that is the same in every court that the board sends a decision to, that there's a timely petition for review filed within that because there's a presumption of regularity that that transmittal letter indicates the decision went out on the same day that
okay,
it occurred.
And that presumption has now been rebutted. Somebody has issued has put in a declaration that they didn't get it.
And
so then what?
And the legal presumption or
– Don't you at least have to have a hearing and make a factual determination at that point?
And the court in Singh has held that the affidavits of non-receipt are not legally sufficient to overcome the factual evidence that the board mailed that decision.
But the question I was posing to you is that even if we did have a hearing, there's nothing more you would be able to show other than what I just articulated.
But I couldn't answer that because I don't know what the board has. Perhaps the board does have – in its possession, a copy of an envelope. I don't think that's the case because I don't think they make copies of postmarked envelopes that have already been mailed. I don't see how they could do that. But
aren't we kind of back to the problem that initially led Congress to change the rule? The simple way to solve the concern here would be to require the agency to go back to certified mail. But I presume for budgetary reasons, Congress decided that it was too expensive to do that every time the BIA mailed something out. So now we have this rule.
Well, I believe that could be a problem is the budgetary concerns, as well as there are still problems with certified mail. You send certified mail to an alien's address of record, and they refuse to sign for it. They don't go pick it up. Someone signs for it who's not authorized. So there are still problems. It's not overcome with certified mail. I believe the Congress reviewed that when determining that certified mail was not adequate.
At least the certified return receipt would give the government a piece of evidence that you could submit at a contested hearing saying, well, we got the green card back, and it shows that somebody signed for this thing on such and such a date, right?
But there still could be other problems when they don't sign for it or someone signs for it. I believe there's case law, someone signed for it who is not authorized to sign for it. And so when the board has these voluminous numbers of decisions to mail out, certified mail may not be the answer. I'd like to briefly, in my time remaining, just address the belated claim that the petitioner did not receive the decision because it was mailed to the incorrect address because of the zip code plus four numbers. That issue was never raised to the board, so petitioners failed to exhaust that argument. He didn't raise it in his opening brief, so there's a waiver of that. But beyond that, he's relying on a Michigan state guideline that says that using the numbers may result in loss of postage discounts, not that it's undeliverable. There's also evidence in the record that the petitioners...
For postage discounts, meaning for bulk mail? Or
I believe so, yes. That's all that I can
claim. It doesn't really support...
That's correct. And there's also evidence in the record that petitioner's counsel did receive, using that same address, did receive the filing receipt for the board's appeal and the board's briefing schedule and filed a brief in compliance with that. So that address was used at least on two occasions by the board, and the petitioner does not complain that they did not receive other items by the board. So that further supports the presumption of delivery. There are no further questions. I see my time is up. The government would respectfully request the court to deny the petition for review.
Thank you very much.
Good argument, Ms. Redfern. You know what you're talking about. So do you, Mr. Yang. Pretty
you,
good
John.
Case to argue.
I appreciate that. What this case is now coming down to, in part, is really the cost of postage versus the cost to my clients' lives.
But that's a determination that Congress made, Mr. Yang. I mean, we used to do it in a way that would have made it more definitive as to whether they received notice, but Congress told the agency, don't use certified mail anymore. And what you're really asking us to do is to declare as a matter of law that the agency has to use something besides the current practice.
Well, I think the court is right in that after my client submitted the declarations of themselves and their client, that the burden has shifted to the government to show by some way that it was mailed. And under the case law of
this
circuit...
Well, the court is right if you don't rely on our questionable decision in Singh, right? Because that argument didn't carry the day with our problem in Singh.
That was... I'm talking about INS v. Salta, the case
about... No, I'm talking about Singh versus Gonzalez, the case that we're going to be here. Are you familiar with that decision?
I'm familiar with it, but I'm not able to...
Well, basically what it says is that simply putting declarations in to contest the receipt is not good enough, that you've got to come up with something more.
Well, here there is something more, Your Honor.
And what is that?
And that would be the fact that the address is not exactly addressed as...
I honestly don't think that's, I mean, a very good argument. I can't believe there's any post... worker in the world who's seeing 0000 wouldn't say, okay, let's forget about those zeros and just deliver it. And that isn't what the thing that you introduced says.
But what else could my clients provide?
Well, that's a different question. That's a different question, and you're right about that. What else could they provide other than I didn't get it?
It's
they don't know why they didn't get it.
Something did not happen. And they've really done all that they could. The fact that the mail was delivered in two other instances does not prove definitively that they received the most important piece of paper, which was the decision, which started the whole clock. And in my time remaining, I'd also like to discuss Judge Tallman's concern as to whether this is a discretionary or non-discretionary function. And really quickly to say, in addition to my prior argument, the IJ has to follow the law. That is not discretionary.
Mr. Yang, what you're really arguing is you're trying to couch an attack on the finding that there was no extreme hardship. You're trying to question a due process argument.
No, I'm not.
Our case law says you can't do that.
No, I have another case where the distinction is relevant. It's currently on rehearing before this court, where it's important. There's prior case law stemming from rules, the transitional rules, which I think this court has promulgated decisions stating that couching a due process argument where it's really an abuse of discretion argument doesn't work. Here, this is a case originating under the permanent rules, and the law is different as far as what jurisdiction, how jurisdiction is established. And it's clear that the immigration judge does not have the discretion to disregard the law. And the law tells her how to weigh different forms of evidence. I'm not asking the court to say that hardship exists. That is proper for the immigration judge to determine. But we are asking for a review of how she got there.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Yang. Thank both of you for your useful argument.
Thank you.
The case of Cruz Ramirez versus Gonzalez is submitted, and we will go to Inouye versus Kemna.